The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Nikki.
And you're joining us for the New Statesman podcast, where this week we're going to talk about what's happening in US politics, because Nikki Wolf is our US editor.
And we'll also be talking about what's annoying us this week.
Spoiler alert, there are quite a lot of things. And welcome to the New Statesman podcast. Nikki Wolf, our new US editor, is joining us this week because Stephen is actually on holiday. I would like to clarify, I wasn't on holiday last week when Stephen claimed that I was. I was on a work trip to Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. But he is in glorious St. Ives, posting Lovely. Lots of photos of himself on Instagram with crabs. I didn't say that. That didn't happen. Nikki, I wanted you to join us because I don't know if you noticed, but some bad stuff is happening in America.
And some good stuff too.
Okay, let's talk about the good stuff first, because I think that's probably the maybe might cheer me up slightly.
So there appears to be a blue wave of left-wing Democrats coming, which is the New York primaries. And New York being Democrats, not a huge surprise. It's a bit like London being Labour, but the Socialist Party of America, Socialist Democratic Party of America?
Right.
The candidate who I think is 28 years old, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I hope I've got the pronunciation right, won in a big upset against kind of party boss Democrat who was very status quo and kind of old school. And there's very much a kind of hopey changey feeling in the air in New York. And you've also got Sex and the City actress
Cynthia Nixon who has turned out to be in many ways the best of Sex and the City's cast.
Yeah.
Although Kim Cattrall, I did see at the opening of Nina Raine's Consent a couple of weeks ago, she's looking great. I can't speak for the other two.
I don't know what the other two are up to.
No, Sarah Jessica Parker went into producing stuff, and then I can't remember the woman who plays Charlotte's name, because it's been a while, and I need to rewatch Sex and the City, although I hear it's now problematic, but then everything from the 90s...
Everything's pretty problematic.
The 90s were problematic.
Friends is quite problematic.
Well, anyway, let's not get diverted to that. But what I thought was interesting is Mehdi Hasan's written his column about ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which is the one that's come in for a lot of heavy criticism this week for separating children from their families, for keeping them in detention centres that, you know, actually do have, I mean, they are cages because they do have chain link fences and tops on them. And he pointed out, you know, the fact that progressive darling Bernie Sanders has actually weirdly been kind of left behind on this one, because he pointedly refused to condemn ICE, whereas Kamala Harris, who's often spoken of as a Democratic presidential nominee next time round, has moved her position quite significantly from March to saying, actually, you know, from being a kind of, I guess, in that kind of classic, you know, Labour Party move way of kind of saying, no, we need to be quite tough on immigration. People need to know that going to go, actually, you're right. When it gets to literally ripping 9-month-old babies away from their mothers, that's the point at which I think we should probably be willing to say, that's not being tough on immigration. That's proto-fascism. Mm. So I suppose that the two sides of that story are that there are you know, appalling things happening in the name of immigration enforcement, both in America and, as it turns out, in Britain, but that the tide has slightly changed and politicians are feeling increasingly empowered, not to mention the Overton window, which I think is a banned phrase in this in this office. But Trump's coming over, isn't he?
In theory, I'm still only about 50-50 as to whether this visit's going to happen.
Because
he knows, he cancels things at the last minute all the time if he suddenly decides he doesn't want to do them.
Do you know what? I think that might be the only thing that I admire about Donald Trump. You know how great it is when you just, how brilliant it is when someone cancels on you at the last minute when you really didn't want to meet them.
Yeah. And certainly that would be the most relief Theresa May has ever felt for anyone cancelling on her.
Yeah.
But I think there's a possibility that if Trump sees huge protests planned, if he's going to get snubbed by the Queen, although the Queen does seem to have scheduled a meeting with him now, the utmost reluctance.
I think they put them in Windsor, haven't they, on the basis that the more they can keep him out of central London, away from people mooning at him, the better.
But the way to deal with Trump, as places like Saudi Arabia have really cottoned onto very early on, and China did this as well when he visited, is to roll out the red carpet and give him as much pomp and circumstance as he can possibly get.
That's a lot easier to do in an authoritarian regime where people are literally in fear that they might be, you know, shot or sacked, right? Whereas the problem is that if you tell a load of Londoners to be really nice to Donald Trump, that's kind of just going to... I think someone's hired a huge inflatable blimp of like a giant orange baby that they were crowdfunding to fly over London. You know, it's one of the joys of living in Britain, I guess. But I suppose we've got not just a queen, but really
we've got the queen. Very much the
world,
the OG queen.
Yeah, so that, presumably he'll like that.
Yeah, and I think he respects that sort of personality, not necessarily personality in terms of a specific personality type, but that kind of figure much more than he respects democratically elected politicians. We saw this at G7, where he sort of rejected or sort of Canada and Theresa May and the leaders of the other kind of...
Merkel and Macron. He's definitely much more comfortable hanging out with authoritarians because they have much better tank displays.
Yeah, although I can't imagine the Queen is that excited to hang out with him.
Yeah, but you know, the Queen has just sat through some absolutely boring old cobblers in her time. Like, just having to show him around a rose garden ranks pretty low on the list of incredibly appalling
things.
It's
possible he and Prince Philip will become best friends.
I actually think Prince Philip will... I don't know. I'm entirely basing my reading of Prince Philip's personality on having recently watched The Crown. But I sort of think that Prince Philip will probably just look at him and think, what a twat. Anyway.
He might say it out loud.
He might. Well, that's the joy of Prince Philip. He really could go either way on that one. But apart from that, what else is happening in American politics?
Going back to the ICE and the border crisis, Sophie McBain, who's our US correspondent, wrote an amazing piece yesterday, or be last week when the podcast comes out. I'm not sure that's the absolute
By the time you listen to this, it will have already happened. She has written the piece.
But it's pointing out that one thing a lot of the outrage has missed is that this is not entirely a brand new Donald Trump phenomenon. This was a program. ICE itself as an agency was founded in 2001 after 9/11. It was greatly expanded its powers under Obama in 2014. Sophie has done a deep dive into the oldest detention center for housing family and child migrants and asylum seekers while they're processed, and sometimes for years and years on end. And it's both horrifying now, and it's been horrifying for a really long time. These are one of the lawyers who spoke to her, who represents some of these children, said that the water is dangerous to drink, that the guards are given bottled water to come to work, but the migrants being housed there, including infants and nursing mothers, are forced to drink this sort of dirty water that's coming through the lead pipes. There's all kinds of allegations of abuse that go on. And it's just been a really horrifying situation for a long time. But I think what Trump has done is made the issue become forced. So people are really outraged about something that they maybe should have been outraged about the whole time, but it's really come to the fore of the political, I hate the word discourse, but it's come
what
to
people
the fore
being kept in cages, like all these chain link kind of boxes pre-Trump then?
So the cages seems like that's because there's been a massively expanded number of migrants being housed. I think it's gone from, I think at the beginning of Trump's term, there was an average of 2,000 migrant children being held. Children and families, that's gone up to about 12,000. So I think and the tent city that's been built in Tornillo, Texas, is essentially an overflow center. So they're still being housed by the same agency under the same rules. There's just more of them now because of the zero tolerance edict that Trump made at the beginning of last year.
And the other big piece of political news from America this week is the Supreme Court's ruling on the Muslim travel ban, or as they ruled, not a Muslim travel ban, right? They ruled that it wasn't discriminatory because it isn't specifically targeted at a particular religion. It's targeted by country. And someone did a great tweet yesterday that said, you know, they're going to make this ruling and it's going to, you know, my prediction is they'll do this ruling saying it's not a Muslim travel ban, and therefore it's not discriminatory. And then 2 hours later, Trump will tweet, great news on the Muslim travel ban.
Except at that point, it won't matter. Because what fundamentally what the Supreme Court, in a quite a tight majority, it was 5-4, I think, but what they ruled was that it doesn't matter what the intention of the law, the law can be racist. You know, fruit of the poison tree doesn't apply here, is essentially what this precedent said. So Trump can set out the law from a place of racist intent, but if the law itself and with its travel ban, it's gone through three iterations, it has been kind of sanded down. And essentially what the justices decided, the majority of the justices, was that if there is a way of reading the law in a non-racist way, which I think they added Chad to the one South American country to the banned list, so it wasn't a specific Muslim country's ban, which is essentially now means that Trump can say, I want to do this racist thing, and as long as the law as written can be interpreted either way, that's no longer unconstitutional.
That's fascinating. I think, as I understand it, Sonia Sotomayor, who was the first Hispanic dissent judge appointed to the court, appointed by Barack Obama, has written an extremely fiery dissent on the subject, as you might imagine. But the other thing, obviously, that brings up is I saw a great tweet, I think that's from Ben Rhodes, Obama's former foreign policy advisor, that, you know, he said, we're talking about the loss of civility in American politics. There's been this big story all week about how Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press spokesman, woman, was refused a dinner at a Red Hen restaurant in Virginia.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, everyone keeps saying the Red Hen. I'm presuming that Red Hen is a well-known chain.
No, it's a small individual artisanal restaurant selling fresh goods from the Shenandoah Mountains. It seems quite... Trump tweeted about it a few days later.
She piled in and kind of, and this is the thing I think is sort of fascinating. So she said, you know, she'd been refused service. This was terrible and hostile and blah, blah, blah. And then someone said, well, actually you tweeting about it is probably going to lead to this place being hit with threats of firebombing. They're going to have to sort of send someone around. And then the president uses his, whatever it is, 18 million Twitter followers to also lamp in against them. But the point that Ben Rhodes made was we talk about the loss of kind of civility about kind of, you know, these norms of polite society. Those were lost in America when Republicans blocked Obama's Supreme Court nominee pick Merrick Garland for an entire last year of his presidency in order that they could wait until Trump was elected, and then they got in Neil Gorsuch, who's clearly, as we saw yesterday, vote is extremely important. And I think that's a really fascinating argument to unpick, is that how the right in America is so hung up on politeness. And the idea that you would be impolite to Sarah Sanders is somehow held up as a kind of greater crime than taking children, like ripping away, telling parents that their children are going to go off for a shower or a bath, and then 20 minutes later when they go, why aren't they back, to go, psych, that you'll be lucky to see your children ever again, is somehow not regarded as impolite, right? I find that absolutely fascinating as a piece of discourse.
But it's also amazing how not new this is. I mean, in a way, American discourse has never been civil, right? I mean, from the, you know, beatings of civil rights protests. I mean, the civil rights movement was, in a way, the kind of similarity in the name of that is telling, because, you know, that was an uncivil age. People were opening fire on marches. People opened fire on student protesters against the Vietnam War in Kent State.
People were being lynched in the early 20th century America.
Murdered. There has never been an age of civility in discourse, and it's just a kind of a dishonest tool by the party in power to try and say it's do as I say, not as I do, right? That's essentially what they're trying to.
I was also thinking about this as a fundamental piece of asymmetry. So as I mentioned at the top last week, I went on a tour of Israel. I went to Tel Aviv, went to Jerusalem, but I also went into the occupied territories. So I went into Bethlehem, I went into Ramallah. And in Ramallah, we met a theatre group who actually are in favour of BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions, which I'm not. But what one of them was saying, a young Palestinian guy was saying, was he went and participated in a programme at, I think it was in Canada, but it was run by MIT. And it was one of these coexistence projects. So there was also a young Israeli guy on it. And the Israeli guy said to him, like, you know, why are you always so angry? Like, I don't even think about the Israel-Palestine conflict. You know, why are you so obsessed with it? And it struck me very much the asymmetry of the powerful, like the people who are holding the cards in that situation. You know, for the vast majority of Israelis, the status quo it's not pleasant. It's not what they would want, but it's bearable. And there is a far greater proportion of people in Ramallah for whom the status quo is not bearable. And that's a similar thing, I think, that you see in America, right, where you can basically say to the other side, why are you so mad about this? Why are you always going on about this? And I see it a lot where... another, you know, to kind of spark off random examples, Jesse Singel, a writer for The Atlantic, wrote a long piece about children who say that they're transgender and how you should deal with them, whether or not you should be watchful and waiting, whether or not you should immediately affirm, you know, their sense of self. And someone did a comment that was like, why is Jesse Singel so obsessed with transgender issues? And it's like, well, he's a reporter with a specialist subject, right? But there is always this kind of, you know, why do you even care about this, that is used as a kind of deflecting tactic to stop people having conversations you don't want them to have.
Yeah. And certainly civil discourse. There's been no more sort of polite protest in America than Colin Kaepernick and the NFL players quietly taking a knee during the national anthem. Right,
which is literally all they do is they kneel down during the national anthem
and
rather than standing
not good
for it.
For the American right. So it's that gives the lie to this whole it's just about politeness thing. They just want to silence voices on the left. But in a way, what that's kind of doing is, and I think Alexandra's victory in the New York primary last night kind of is a sign of this, that you're pushing the left towards these kind of, in what I think is a good and healthy way. But you also see, you know, people calling for, there was neo-Nazi guy who was punched and set off this whole hand-wringing argument about whether it's okay to punch Nazis. But
this is a white supremacist Richard Spencer.
Spencer, yeah.
Yeah. At around the same time, the same weekend, in fact, that a white supremacist ran over a woman in a car at the protest and killed her, right?
Yeah, so, at the hair.
Yeah, so you have a complete asymmetry of like...
Well, I think that was at Charlottesville, which was in late summer. Spencer was punched on Inauguration Day. Thing.
Okay, my recollection was those two events happened weirdly in the sort of similar kind of news cycle.
I think someone else was also. I think Spencer might have been punched again. Actually,
I mean, I can see how that is a regular hazard for him. Yeah, I think it's those kind of discourses about civility really fascinating. And the New Yorker has got a piece in this week about Berkeley, the university in California, and how much it cost them in the end $3 million to host a press conference by Miley Yiannopoulos because they were so determined not to hand him the victory. Of saying I've been barred. He got invited by a kind of tiny student society between about 5 and 30 people.
This
and
is
then,
the quote unquote free speech week.
Yeah, exactly, right? And he said that Steve Bannon was going to appear and Steve Bannon didn't appear to know anything about it.
As well.
And Pamela Geller.
Who said she'd been barred and it turned out they hadn't offered her enough money, so she had turned it down and then turned around and tweeted that she had been barred.
I bar myself from a lot of things because people don't offer me enough money to do them, or I just fundamentally don't want to do them. But I think this is all part of the same kind of thing about a sort of desire to be, particularly on that bit of the American hard right, to be seen, to feel oppressed and to feel that people are kind of, and to represent any kind of knockback that you get as being equivalent to systemic racism or sexism or whatever it might be.
And it's difficult for them because they, and I don't think anyone really, certainly a lot of the reporting we've seen come out in places like Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, none of them really expected Trump to win. Certainly Trump himself didn't expect to win. So now in a way, they're the dog that caught the car, right? They still have the attitude of an insurgent oppositionary force who just also happen to be controlling the administration of both houses of Congress, and they have no idea what to do with themselves. Now, they still behave as if they're the oppressed minority, because in fact they control all the...
Right, which just means that they fundamentally don't want to do politics.
Yeah.
They don't want to do the hard...
Well, they don't want to do governance.
Yeah, right, legislative grind of actually trying to make people's lives incrementally better in, you know, by through legislative and systematic means. What they want to do is just have a massive op-ed column.
Yeah.
The condition of modern life.
Bannon, who won the presidency, still considers himself a Leninist outsider.
Yeah, that is a very strange quirk of modern life. The fact that everybody wants to be out on the outside. And I know as journalists, this is a kind of deeply hypocritical thing. Why does everyone want to be on the outside just complaining about stuff rather than getting on and doing it? But, you know, I sort of see that as a protected characteristic of journalists, right? That's what we're for. And that's why we, you know, I don't think, you know, shouldn't accept honours, shouldn't do, you know, we shouldn't become, try as much as possible not to become part of a system. Their function is completely different.
Except Bannon's gone completely rogue now, because he is now spending most of his time trying to unseat more quote-unquote moderate, because none of these people are really that moderate at this point, but he's trying to unseat moderate Republicans more than he's trying to unseat Democrats. So he was the big spat he had with the administration, obviously, last November, was that he was supporting Roy Moore, whereas the Trump and the administration supported Luther Strange, who would probably have won that race because he wasn't a credibly accused child sexual predator. But
right, Roy Moore had been like banned from shopping malls.
Banned from shopping malls, yeah.
Because people were so worried about his tendencies. And whereas Luther Strange just merely laboured under having the name of a supervillain.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, in America is almost a plus these days.
And the same thing happened in the primaries last night, where Bannon was supporting in Staten Island, Michael Graham, whereas the Trump administration was supporting his opponent, whose surname is Donovan. I can't remember his first name. Actually, I haven't checked to see what the result was in that race.
Oh, well, we can. Someone can probably write in. Or you could just, you know, Google. But the midterms are coming up. How do you see them playing out?
So it certainly does feel like people are talking a lot about the blue wave. The Virginia elections last year swung heavily for the Democrats. The Pennsylvania 18th district, 20-point swing to the Democrats. On the other hand, first of all, I and everyone else have been completely burned doing anything that sounds like making predictions over the last couple of years. But also, there's still no group of people on the planet who could snatch defeat from the jaws of victory quite like the Democratic Party.
On that unpleasant note, thank you very much, Nikki Wolf.
Thank you.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
And now for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Yes, you're so much more enthusiastic about it than Stephen is. Although we did have a listener write in and complain that they find that bit annoying. So sorry to that listener. But we're not going to...
They phrase it as a question?
No, they didn't, unfortunately. You literally can't make us. The question this week is... What's annoying you most, Nikki?
Well, I've been reading, and it came out a while back, so it's not a brand new hot off the presses book review, but I've been reading Homo Deus, which was the sequel to Sapiens by...
Yuval Noah Harari.
And it's just not very good. He keeps talking about the youth of today not keeping diaries, which...
Right, they have blogs now. That's what... Live Journal was all diaries, or, you know, Twitter is like an option for people as a diary.
Yeah,
record a lot of text about their lives, or video diary, like YouTube.
I think sort of in terms of keeping track of their daily lives and thoughts, it does not feel like that's something that the current kind of youth gen. Even the phrase "the youth of today" is a red flag. But he also insists the entire way through the book on calling the Internet of Things the Internet of All Things, which.
Is that a point about his belief that everything will eventually be a smart whatever, like a smart toaster and a smart kettle and a smart, you know, hob and a smart...
But his wider point about that and is to make it sound like this kind of sinister sort of singularity point that, like, it sounds much more threatening, right? When you talk about the possibilities of the Internet of All Things.
The Internet of Things is generally quite a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because, for example, like people get smart locks and then the Wi-Fi goes down and then they can't unlock their house anymore. That's bad.
Yeah, or if North Korean hackers get into your fridge and your milk goes off.
Fair. No, I mean, Cory Doctorow used to have an example about what would happen to your smart thermostat if the government during a cold winter decided to turn all the dissidents', you know, thermostats down. Like you could die of cold in your sleep. Like the possibilities for really screwing quite majestically with lots of people at the same time. Baby monitors that were recording stuff. You know, and also because none of them have got any really decent security, you can turn them into botnets.
There was an unbelievably terrifying demonstration at a hacking conference in Las Vegas last year where a hacker in 35 seconds flat, broke into the computer system controlling the autopilot system on a, I think it was a Tesla, the kind of self-driving, it's somewhere between a self-driving car and cruise control. This is the thing where someone was watching a movie and went and it mistook a lorry crossing the road for the sky and went straight under it and entirely decapitated him, to which Elon Musk said, well, actually, statistically, it's still safer, which is not what you say after
99% of people who use our cars haven't been decapitated. Like, why aren't we talking about them?
Yeah, it's that whole thing of, and it's the wider sense of it. And there's a lot of rationalist academics, a lot of whom my brother has got very into recently, like Sam Harris. And I think it's Steven Pinker whose point is that, like, and it's another, well, actually,
violence is decreasing. That's Stephen
Pinker's. Things in general are much better at the moment.
Which is, again, and George pointed out this great phrase that Stuart Wood used to use, which was about immigration, which is voters don't live their lives in the macro.
Yeah.
And it's a very good summation of, you can say all you like, well, actually, violence is, but if you're in South Sudan currently or Syria, that's not an enormous comfort to you as you pick up your, you know, last few remaining belongings and try and head for an internally displaced persons camp.
Yeah.
So
James at the pub the other night made the point that it's
this would be James Ball, formerly of Guardian and BuzzFeed,
You go to someone being mugged and they're sort of being stabbed 15 times, you're like, well, it may make you feel better to realise that you're actually six times less likely for this to happen to you. But it still happens.
Yeah, right. So exactly. So, okay, so you're annoyed about Homo Deus. Are you going to carry on finishing reading it, or are you a person who jettisons books halfway through?
I habitually don't jettison books halfway through. I actually just finished it. And the annoyingness ramps up towards the end when he starts talking about it's all very techno-futurist. And I spent a year reporting out of Silicon Valley, at the end of which I went to Burning Man. And had quite enough of techno-futurism to a certain extent. The idea, and Elon Musk is the kind of ne plus ultra of all of this. But
so this
idea
is the guy who founded PayPal, and he was...
It was one of the eBay mafia.
Yeah, I was going to say him and Piero Modgia, who now funds The Intercept. Yeah. So he made an enormous amount of money, which now he's put into Dragon X, his space travel company, and also Tesla, his electric car company, which, you know, he... And also the Hyperloop, which I think Alex Hearn at The Guardian is obsessed with whether or not that will ever happen. And why wouldn't you just build more buses, build a tube?
But living in San Francisco is really kind of edifying in this kind of way, because you've got these people saying, you know, we can build this train that'll take you from Los Angeles to San Francisco in 35 minutes or whatever. But the streets of San Francisco are filled with tent cities of homeless people. They can't solve even the basic problems of civic governance in their own backyard. And
this kind of is another version of the disease that we were talking about before, right? Which is people who don't want to do the bit where you actually levy taxes on local businesses and people and use it to pay for civil infrastructure. What they want to do is, I want to go to the moon.
Yeah. And the same thing just happened with Amazon in Seattle, where Amazon successfully lobbied to block new business tax raise that would have been aimed to address the homelessness problem in Seattle, which has a similar problem. Because a lot of the cities on the west coast of the US, cities in the middle, used to solve their homelessness problems by shipping all their people on a bus out west, basically. But there's just not... every time one of these cities that's dominated by a big tech industry tries to levy new taxes on that industry to help it solve its problems, they just get completely blocked.
Because those problems are too boring.
Yeah, and Elon Musk himself, having spent, and there's an argument that they needed a test payload anyway, but having quite publicly spent a lot of money shooting a Tesla car into space, has just laid off 10% of the Tesla workforce, which is not a great look, whichever way you kind of slice it.
Yeah, I find that whole culture absolutely fascinating, because it's got such a specific, you know, they call it the California ideology, right? There's a specific kind of guy. They're most, you know, they're often from the same kind of couple of places. I think, I mean, Elon Musk is slightly different because he's originally South African, right? But, you know, they have a very similar outlook. They have a very kind of, like techno-libertarianism, right? They sort of just, they believe that either everybody's...
Peter Thiel, especially.
Yeah, like kind of, Peter Thiel, who once wrote a thing about seasteading, about how he wanted to build an island in the middle of the sea so you wouldn't have to obey, you know, international waters, so you wouldn't have to obey labor regulations.
And who funded the lawsuit that killed Gorka, and who also is rumored to have injections of teenagers' blood in order to keep him youthful.
I think he's denied the teenagers' blood. I think that was the one that pushed him far enough to kind of go, I'll cough to the island in the sea.
For legal purposes, we can't say that Peter Thiel gets injections of teenagers' blood.
No, I'm slightly older.
But he definitely does.
He doesn't, no. officially he doesn't. The thing that's really been annoying me is a kind of slightly wider one, but related to what you said, actually, which is the way that Brexit has absolutely paralysed politics and the way that it is impossible to get any other subject to get any proper oxygen. This week, Rory Stewart, who's a politician I admire in a lot of ways, who's now a prisons minister, was up in front of a Select Committee.
He walked across Afghanistan.
He did, yeah, and he's and also his constituency, which is really quite far north. So two very admirable things.
I don't think we can compare Scotland with that.
To Cumbria, no, probably not.
No, it's not Scotland, is it?
It's Cumbria. Right. It's the borders, Penrith. But he, you know, he admitted that the probation contracts under, guess who, Chris Grayling, friend of the podcast,
oh God,
Chris Grayling, had been underpriced and was simply undeliverable, and they're going to have to renegotiate a significant number of them. You know, at the same time, consistently problems with our prisons. The prisons inspector all the time is going into prisons finding really overcrowding, unsanitary conditions. They've just scrapped ideas for women's community prisons. Now, the vast majority of women who are in prison are for non-violent offences. You know, short sentences for women are incredibly disruptive for lives, particularly those who have care responsibilities. We know that a huge number of women in prison are of themselves victims of abuse. So all the kind of any kind of idea that the prison state is getting better is now, I think, fully dead. But, you know, can you get any attention to that? It's so hard because the only stuff that's going through this legislative session, really, apart from Heathrow expansion, and we all think, well, what's the point of that? Because Heathrow expansion's probably got another 20 years of arguing before any kind of creeps any closer to actually happening. You know, is the EU withdrawal bill. We haven't even seen a date yet for the domestic violence bill, which was a kind of other flagship legislation. And, you know, as a reporter, commentator on this stuff, I find that really different. You've got two very divergent situations in Britain and America. In America, stuff is happening all the time, too much stuff to cover. No sooner has one outrage happened than we're on to the next one. Mm. And actually, it's just a blizzard. And trying to pick out what's important versus what's shiny and new is the kind of really hard thing, I think, there. Here you've got the other opposite problem, which is you've got loads and loads of grinding, endless wrangling and bureaucracy and internal debates about stuff and trying to give people a sense of not just don't switch off, like this stuff's actually really quite important. And also given the press has fallen into such partisan lines along Brexit, I find it very difficult to kind of keep my ballast. And I do, you know, because I think the Brexity papers are so ready to call any kind of grumpiness about from business project fear that maybe I worry I'm kind of being sending myself in the opposite direction. I think
yeah,
it's
and
fundamentally,
we just had Airbus saying that they were
right. That they're putting out a very sober assessment about the fact that even a soft Brexit they think will have some impact, but WTO terms will lose them £1 billion a week because their supply chain is spread out across Europe. And it's very difficult to find people that you trust and people who appear to have stayed sane. So on both sides of the Atlantic, you know, I think it's really interesting to see the way quite a lot of the rest of the American media that I follow has turned against the New York Times, for example. They are really kind of quite hated out there, but also huge and putting a lot of money in, you know, they're kind of unavoidable.
Yeah, some parts of them don't help themselves as well. I mean, the Atlantic hiring Kevin Williamson, who's the guy who said that
women who have abortion should be hanged.
Yeah, as it's this weird thing of American media that they seem to have this.
Well, the American
CNN
left,
does it as well.
The American liberal media is really hung up on the idea that you should have a breadth of voices, which is not something that Fox News particularly troubles itself.
Yeah, no, it's not something the opposite. It's too civil, if anything.
Yeah, so it is an asymmetry again. Okay, that's good. So you're annoyed by a book that you've just read. I'm annoyed by existence. That's a nice note to end the podcast on. Thank you for joining me, Nikki.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Ose, and my co-presenter this week, Nikki Wolf. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not sign up for a subscription or at least register on our website, because Nikki needs new shoes.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.